Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Maria Golia. She managed the Caravan of Dreams Performing Arts Center in Fort Worth, Texas, and we're talking about her latest book, Ornette Coleman, The Territory and the Adventure. Now, Maria, when I read this book, I came away with it as feeling it wasn't a traditional biography. It was in part, but it gave me more of a context for Ornette's life, and I found that really interesting. It made me understand both the person and his music better. Talk to me about making that choice.
Okay. Hi, Mark, first of all. And yes, of course, when we start a book, we want to see what we can really add to the conversation. And as I'm not a musician, nor am I a music writer, I thought that what I could best add would be context. Because I'm very into research, for one thing, but also I lived in Fort Worth, where Ornette grew up.
And you also managed the Caravan of Dreams Performing Arts Center, where he played.
That's why I was there. Yeah, that was why I was there. So I had that, you know, that experience hovering in the background. It was quite some time ago. It was in the mid '80s to early 1990s. So I knew Fort Worth, and of course I knew a little something about New York. I knew something about that moment in history because I sort of just missed it, but it was an important moment for me. I'm talking about the 60s. So I made the choice of doing it based on what I felt I was able to do, but also because I don't think you can really understand somebody's work unless you understand what it comes out of, what has fed into it,
right,
and what it's coming out of.
It's interesting. We're a jazz station here, and
right.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about Ornette Coleman and especially free jazz, it's like one of those divisive things. People either really, 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 really love it, or they're really not wild about it.
Yeah, it's true. It's
it's like abstract paintings.
Yeah, or masks in America.
Right. Don't go there. Just don't go there.
Right. But I mean it's true that Ornette seems to appeal to a certain kind of shall we say eclectic global tribe, but at the same time, you know, it depends what you listen to. I mean, Ornette, you know, I think those of our generation, I assume that we're kind of the same age, sort of, you know,
yeah,
these people, we had associations with Ornette that placed him squarely in this moment of opening that was this time when all the arts were breaking with convention, whether it was music, literature,
right,
theater, film, photography. So, you know, people, I think, who experienced that moment or saw, idealized, in my case, that moment as a moment of opening, saw him at sort of the center of that experiment in freedom of expression. And so sort of like him a priori, almost, if you like.
Huh.
But there's a lot to his music. I mean, because going, if you go back to it now, at the time, you know, he was very, you know, sort of marginal. But if you go back and listen to some of that music now, it makes perhaps more sense than it did at the time, precisely because of the conventions that it was breaking with, which were mostly bebop conventions. So, you know, what is it about this music? It depends where you grab him, because you could get some of his stuff that's more obtuse, if you like, the, you know, these double octets,
yep,
the septets of free jazz when it's, you know, cacophonous, which he loved cacophony, by the way, because he had a very, very good ear. He liked to pick his way. He could find his way through this morass of sound, you know, like a spore tracker. but there's lots of other stuff that's much more quote unquote not just accessible, because it shouldn't be that way. More, I think that people can relate to more easily. So it depends which tail you of this tiger you sort of grab it at.
You described the era that this book focuses on. I found this really interesting because I grew up in this era. More receptive and inquisitive, less pressured and afraid. Can you just elaborate on that? Because that really struck me, especially in here in 2020. Having lived through that time period, it was a very different time period.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were, like, so fortunate. I mean, maybe a lot of people say this when they get to the States. But I have to say, objectively speaking, look, the world was, you know, there was much less. I live in Cairo, where it's very, very clear what population density means to daily life. So the world was a smaller place in that way. It was more open. You could travel more freely. There was no HIV/AIDS, so you know there was a lot more freedom in that in that regard. There was you could move. You could there was space. There was opening. You know, and then there had also been this moment of this whole atomic bomb thing and this notion of the possibility of annihilation. And I think that youth, coupled to that moment of annihilation, the idea of all possibilities and that and just, you know, sort of explosively went with that kind of opposite energy. So, yeah, I mean, nothing is ideal, right? And again, one is idealizing something that belongs to or, you know, is associated with youth. But objectively speaking, it was a much more free and open time. This is also pre-internet, by the way.
Right.
Which means that face-to-face encounters was what an encounter was. You know, there was no alternative to that, nor would one have wished for there to be. And here's where people will say, ah, you're being nostalgic. And that's where I say, no, I'm being practical. The fact is that, you know, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, all of this happened by people, you know, at most using the telephone. And yet there was tremendous organization across America throughout universities and, you know, organizations and so forth. There was motivation. Things happen when people are for real together much more than they happen under the present circumstances.
Now, Arnette was born in Fort Worth, Texas, and as you describe it, culturally Western, not Southern. That's how they looked at themselves. And it was in the neighborhood of Hillside. What was Hillside like at that time?
Well, it was down by the railroad tracks, and Fort Worth was a big slaughterhouse town, and they would send the meat up to, there was a big Swift and Armor plant there, a meat packing plant, and then they would also send cattle further north. It was on what they called the Chisholm Trail, you know, which was basically a big cattle trail that started in southern Texas and worked its way up, because Fort Worth and Dallas are further to the north of Texas. So Fort Worth was the stopover town for the cowboys bringing up those very big herds of cattle.
It's so hard to imagine him growing up in this environment.
Right. He, you know, he became a vegetarian, which was, you know, one more reason to think he was a weirdo. You know.
But, you know, you time and again, you bring up how important music was to the black communities that were there. The life of the black community revolved around music. His older sister, Tuvenza, was a blues singer and a band leader. And at an early age, now I got to make sure I got this right, he said, I don't need to worry about keys, chords, and melody if I had that emotion that brought tears and laughter to people's hearts. That's a pretty bold statement for a young musician.
Well, he wasn't young when he made it. He was reflecting on his youth, I think. Yeah, but
he was an outsider. He was different even at that time.
Yeah, no, he was. I mean, the music scene there that he belonged to, that a lot of his other friends. And by the way, Fort Worth, you know, may have been a meatpacking town, but boy, did it churn out some of the great avant-garde musicians of our time. I mean, he went to school with all of them, practically. They all went to I.M. Terrell High School, which was the only black high school for miles around. And so it was really kind of a nexus for musical talent. Of course, they had church bands, and then they had the high school band, and you know, a lot of people played in both. Like Ornette, he played in both.
But you would sort of expect him to be more of a blues, you know, who had grew up with a more of a blues or Western tradition. But how did he sort of strike out in this direction of abstract jazz?
Well, there was all kinds of music around. So he grew up in this very, very, rich ambiance of sound at that time, because you had all the swing bands on the radio, this big brassy sound. You had where he was in Texas, you had Tejano music, and you had country Western swing, what they call, and you had R&B, and you had the church music. Wow. And then you had some people, you know, experimenting with bebop, because this is just now when Dizzy Gillespie is making, you know, waves, and then with Charlie Parker as well. So these kids, you know, I mean, I guess he was around 15 when he got that first Charlie Parker record. And so many of these young musicians that I spoke to speak of that moment of hearing either Dizzy Gillespie or often Charlie Parker play just something that, you know, literally blows the top of their heads off. You know, it's just something so exciting for them. So they would get together, and although, you know, Ornette had an R&B band from the time he was 16 with some of his high school mates, because, you know, it was during the war and the older guys were at war, he had a group of friends that he would listen to and you know, emulate bebop with, because you couldn't really play that in the clubs or the, you know, what was the pass for clubs, basically. These were, you know, beer joints and juke joints, and yeah, there was a couple straight up clubs, but there was just a huge amount of music, diverse, all this swirl of music.
Wow.
He grew up in that, but it was bebop that turned him on, because remember, this came against the backdrop of R&B. Now he's playing R&B in these, you know, pretty, like, you know, rough kinds of places where, you know, there'd be fighting and, you know, women and dice and all this kind of
things. It's never a good combination.
Well, no, actually, it could have been a lot of fun, you know, but he wasn't into that. You know, he was more, you know, see, he didn't like the idea that the music he was playing, which was R&B, was working people up into this particular kind of lather, you know. So bebop appealed to him because it was more intellectual. He told this to Jacques Derrida in an interview with him in the later 1990s, that he saw bebop as a way out. You know, bebop demanded a certain amount of intellectual ability on top of whatever musical skill you might have, you know, with this, its way of trans, you know, taking things apart and putting them back together again, melodies and so forth. So it was a challenge for him, and that engaged him. And then he, of course, he left that behind as well.
Well, he travels to L.A., and as you write, L.A. is like the home of cool jazz, the sort of more laid-back, I think did you say blasé bebop? Sort of Miles Davis, Jerry Mulligan. Right. And it's only for a short time that he's in Los Angeles, but a lot of things happen to him. One of them is that he meets Sally Jane Richardson, has a son, Donardo, who he ends up later recording with. And then he meets, I think it's there that he meets Don Cherry.
Yes. Don Cherry was a friend of Jane Cortez. That's his wife. That was the name. She took her maternal grandmother's name, Cortez. So, yeah, that's how they met, through Jane. You know, Ornette was just starting to find the people that he could run the kinds of experiments that he was interested in running with. So he had Ed Blackwell,
yep,
from that he had met in New Orleans. He had Bobby Bradford, a trumpet player from Texas that he met up with in Los Angeles. And then he had, eventually in Los Angeles, he met, of course, Charlie Hayden, which was a big deal, but that was a bit, it was around the same time. So, and then Billy Higgins, at some point, Ed Blackwell went off to play with, I think, Ray Charles. So he got Billy Higgins, who was playing with Don Cherry. They were both the same age, that is to say, several years younger than Ornette. So they were excited and malleable, and Ornette was very into, you know, he didn't like the idea of settling into a style. He said, a style is what happens when your phrases harden, you know, so it was this idea that a style is like almost an ossification of the creative process, that something that he wanted to avoid, and playing with, you know, people who were willing to take things in different directions. You know, they would all be his original compositions. They would play them over and over in different ways. And he needed people who were down with that. You know, who were willing to go for this goal that was somehow almost, you know, esoteric. That you knew it when you got it, but you couldn't necessarily say what it was. You know, in terms of as an ensemble. Producing ensemble music.
You're listening to WSN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Maria Golia. She managed the Caravan of Dreams Performing Arts Center in Fort Worth, Texas, and we're talking about her latest book. It's just one of these wonderful reads. Ornette Coleman, The Territory and the Adventure. He, by August 1958, he's nominated by Downbeat as an alto saxophone news star. His first recording contract is with the L.A.-based Contemporary Records, and he meets Sonny Rollins. In 1959 or 1954, he goes to the Lenox School of Jazz, which is here in Massachusetts, with Don Cherry, and spent a year there. But eventually he ends up going to New York City, and this is what I want to talk about, where this is really the break. I think you always talk about these big concerts. You wish you were there. Everybody claims they were in the room. But at the Five Spot Cafe, he goes to play. And this seems to be the big breakout concert where all the jazz critics are going to come and they're going to write about you afterwards. Talk to me about that concert.
Right. Well,
it was 1959, November 17th. Excuse me.
Right, right. Well, all of Ornette's planets were aligned in 1959. As you mentioned, he was at Lenox, and that was a big experience for him. It was John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet, who he met in L.A., who hooked him up with that. And it was just a very mind-opening experience for him. He met musicologist Günther Schuller there. He met Texan musician Jimmy Jeffrey there. He met different people there that you know, just enriched his whole, I think, perspective. And also in that year, I think it was at Newport that he played briefly with there was Coleman Hawkins and another great saxophonist. It was like an ordination almost. But then the best was yet to come, which was when, and then he got nominated, like you said, with the Downbeat thing. But then he gets to New York, and New York was like. The Five Spot Cafe was kind of a, you know, very known but underground, the place to you know, for outstanding or new music. Thelonious Monk played there. Cecil Taylor played there. And I don't know how much Ornette knew about the Five Spot when he got there or about that New York scene because he was, you know, on the other, he was over there. I mean, he knew the musicians. You know, he knew the work of some of these musicians, certainly. But I don't know how much he knew about the place. But the place had this reputation. He probably would have known that. But curiously, when they booked him, because there had been a lot of brouhaha about his talents, and I think that they were a little bit, the guys who owned it, the two guys who owned it, one of them was a butcher, a former butcher, I think. Oh, God. No, that was the Cedar Tavern, sorry. Anyway, the guys who booked it, they to be on the safe side, they booked this group called the Jazz Tet, which was a lot of very established bebop New York musicians. And so they figured, you know, well, we got a sure thing. If this Ornette character from Texas, you know, bombs, you know, we still have the Jazz Tet to back us up. But the thing is that when, as soon as Ornette and his quartet, which started playing, they, I think it was Paul Blais, the pianist Paul Blais, said that, I'm paraphrasing, but the Jazz Tet, oh no, he didn't, I'm not paraphrasing, he said the Jazz Tet sounded like Guy Lombardo. And of course, Guy Lombardo, for those, you know, who weren't
oh,
there,
God.
was a big sort of ballroom dance band leader, you know, something very
that your grandmother would listen to.
Yeah. But that, you know, he played at the Waldorf Astoria every New Year's Eve. He was kind of an American institution of blandness, you know, just essence of bland. So, you know, that was a real put down. But the fact is that at that moment, really from that moment, the opinion, public, you know, critical opinion, there were a lot of critics in the audience, there were a lot of musicians in the audience, and everybody went either straight to the, this is really something, or else to, in the opposite direction. You know, what is it, what's wrong with this guy kind of thing. And opinion was immediately and sharply divided. It was just some wonderful critical writing about that debut, which I try to put as much as possible into the book because it's great. There were some British, you know, there were people, there were Brits, there were some others from somewhere else, like Germany or somewhere. I mean, this was kind of a, because it was New York, right?
And yeah.
It was at this particular moment, so it wasn't just Dornett, it was the place already, which had this cachet. But one of the Brits wrote that Ornette's music is, he said, it's like musical Kipper. There's a lot of, you have to pick through the bones, but some of it is good. You know, kind of
thing. Oh, my God.
So different, and, you know, people said, yeah, he's really happening. Other guys, you know, I have to tell my therapist about this. You know, there was all these, you know, remarks to the one side or the other side. So there was this huge controversy. And then that's where the critics had to decide, are they for or against? You know, and basically, if they were into Ornette, that meant that they were dissing the status quo, which comprised some very brilliant and daring musicians, you know. And then if they weren't for him, though, then they were square, you know, which was pretty bad thing to be, square. So you know, the thing is that he got people talking. And as my friend John Rockwell, who was a culture critic for the New York Times, said, he said, a scene happens when the critics pay attention, and they were definitely paying attention to Ornette.
Maria, we're going to run out of time before we do much more, but I have to talk to you about this. Ornette had this theory or an idea. It's called the harmelodic.
Right.
Can you explain anything about what that was? It seems extremely abstract. I know that he would encourage the bass and the drums, and this is from your book too, to explore the melody and the harmony rather than just playing their roles as the rhythmic backbone. But what is harmelodic beyond that?
Well,
this is a term he coined, right? He coined this himself.
Yeah, harmony. It's basically harmony, melody, movement, or rhythm. But he backed into this idea. Harmelodics was the name, or it was his theory, it was his approach. When he spoke about what he was doing, it was his way of describing what it was that he was doing, basically. And what he was doing had to do with his going back to this idea of oral, you know, complexity. He loved this complexity. He was very interested in things happening all at once. You know, he was interested in this visually. He made a lot of observations about, you know, for example, he would compare his music to a street where many things are happening. Someone's getting out of a car, a woman's kissing her husband goodbye, the dog is barking, yeah, you know, whatever, all this kind of stuff. So he was very interested in this, and but you know, I go into this, and I thought I made it quite clear, Mark, in my book, What is Harmelodic? But the best description, which is the shortest one, is the one I'll give, which is Jackie McLean, who was a sax player, says that the thing about Ornette is that you know, everybody had been playing, you know, harmony, melody, and rhythm separately, and then some guy comes along, and, you know, he said it's like a suit, and you got the pants and the jacket and the vest, and it's harmony, melody, and everybody's got it really worked out just like that. Then this guy comes along with a jumpsuit, you know, and yeah. So basically what Ornette did was, you know, he wanted to break down the barriers between which instrument plays which with harmony, melody, and rhythm, that anybody could do that, okay? If you were drum, you didn't have just to be rhythm. You could be harmony, you could be melody, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what put the jump in the suit. That was his harmelodics.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Now, you actually met Ornette, although briefly, but you met him in Fort Worth, didn't you?
Yes, I worked with him. We booked him several times. He played. He also recorded it with the Caravan of Dreams Productions record label. But I only had a chance to spend quality time with him once, which is when we went to have barbecue at his favorite barbecue place on the south side of Fort Worth called Roger Hughes. And I had never been there. For whatever reason, and he said, "Oh boy, you're in for a treat." And so we hung out a bit, and he introduced me to strawberry soda as well, which was quite a fantastic experience. But he was a very soft-spoken kind of guy who wore these, very wild kinds of print shirts and. He was very unassuming, but there was a whole lot going on beneath that very calm and kind exterior.
It's an extraordinary. This is an extraordinary book about an extraordinary person, and it's also got a lot of interesting background things, particularly about the Caravan of Dreams Performing Arts Center, which is no more. The building is there, but it seems like it's a shadow of its former self.
No, it's much worse than that.
It's a sub-shadow?
In one of history's great reversals, Mark, it was turned into a steakhouse.
Oh.
A former progressive arts venue where everyone that you can name who was a great and marvelous American musician and a couple of foreigners as well, quite a few actually, played and performed for days at a time to raucous, adoring crowds.
Wow.
Progressive music. Raucous, adoring white, black, and brown crowds, by the way, that is to say, thoroughly integrated crowds in this. Now they turned it into a steakhouse. So, that tells you all you need to know about what's happened in America in the last.
We are completely out of time, and we literally have only scratched the surface of this book. My guest tonight has been writer Maria Golia. She managed the Caravan of Dreams Performing Arts Center in Fort Worth, Texas. And we're talking about her latest book. It is really worth reading. Ornette Coleman, The Territory and the Adventure. Maria, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.